Hi, everybody. My name is Cameron Munter, and I'm the CEO and president of the East-West Institute in New York. Welcome to another exciting episode of the EWI podcast, a platform where we try to dissect some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. As always, you're welcome to check out all of our podcast episodes available on our website, on SoundCloud, and on iTunes, all under the name of East-West Institute. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming a good friend of mine, an exceptional journalist and academic, Steve Call. Steve is currently Dean of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He is also the recipient of two Pulitzer Prize Awards, one of them for a book that I'm sure many of our listeners have read entitled Ghost Wars. Steve, welcome to the EWI podcast.
Thanks for having me, Cameron. Great to be with you.
You recently launched your latest book called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Is it fair to say that this is a continuation of Ghost Wars, or how did you take your approach to this book, and what do you hope to get across to audiences, especially the audience that knows Ghost Wars?
It is a sequel. I mean, it's intended as a sequel, but as I note in the introduction, it can also be read independently without reading Ghost Wars first. And it was an interesting engineering challenge, as you know, as an author. I mean, you can imagine writing a two-part history intentionally and setting up choices in the first part so you can continue them in the second. But I didn't do it that way. I had a large gap between the first and the second volume. And the first volume had a lot of readers, so when I thought about the second, I recognized that I had to write it in a way that readers of the first would see as a continuation of the strategies or the tones and the approaches of the first. And yet, this history, as you know, is very different from the history covered in Ghost Wars. That book ends on September 10th. This begins on September 10th, really September 11th, and comes forward to something like the present day. And it's a time, instead of covert history primarily, there's also a big overt war going on, and the context is different. So I wrestled with that for some time before taking it on. But in the end, I'm gratified that people have received it as a recognizable extension of Ghost Wars. My other anxiety was, of course, part twos, whether it's Ghostbusters or Caddyshack or whatever it is you might have enjoyed the first time around, or often received as a diminished version of the first volume. But
don't forget that Godfather 2 also
won. Godfather 2 is what I was going for. Okay, yes. Some people think it's better than Godfather. So.
Right. So really, when you think about that, it's an interesting problem. It's one that you had a very tight kind of structure for a Ghost Wars, that it ends on the 10th of September, but those who are reading it, which came out, what, 2003,
four.
They know what comes next.
Right.
Now you have a number of people who are reading this version, Directorate S, and I'd like to get into the substance in just a minute, but there is not a sense that there is an event that you know about that comes next. It brings you, as you said, more or less up to the present. What kind of advantage or disadvantage does that give you?
Well, I think it was mostly a disadvantage in comparison to Ghost Wars, in the sense that a writer always likes to know where a story ends before you begin. And it was clear that I was only going to have a kind of a half ending at best in this case. But I thought there was an analogous advantage, which was that I felt we were probably ready for some kind of an account of how we got from there to here across 17 years, our country's longest war. So many Americans, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, rotated through Afghanistan in one form of service or another. And I think there was a sense of exhaustion with the subject, perhaps, but also a sense of yearning for some sense of why. Why did this happen the way it did? How did we struggle so badly with our objectives? And why are we still in this mess, and maybe for another 5 or 10 years? And so that was the mission. It was more of a kind of Pentagon Papers opportunity than a thriller with an ending in a big bang. But the history in that way has the same texture. It's set up in the same triangle: the embassy in Islamabad, where you served, the embassy in Kabul, the Arg Palace, the decision-making at the National Security Council, the CIA's role both in the interagency and then independently in the field. And so I used many of the same strategies.
You did, and I think what one of the successes that the reviews have pointed out is that it's comprehensive without being plotting. It is an interesting story, and yet there are conclusions, many different conclusions you can draw, perhaps not as unified as the earlier book. What are the key things that you see that you wanted to get across about Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan, about the way that America understood the war, about priority and the way that governance works in the United States when you're dealing with foreign affairs? What are the key issues you'd like people to know?
Well, let's pluck out a few. There's probably a half a dozen or a dozen, but I would start with my own experience as a researcher, which is, you know, I kind of covered this war as a beat reporter. I was out there for The New Yorker a fair amount. I felt like I understood more or less what had happened. I knew many of the personalities, interviewed them. But when I went back to really excavate the decision making at different points along the way and to try to get down another layer as to who said what to whom and how were these decisions made on what basis, I was struck for the first time at just the complexity of the problem of our war aims, and especially our vision of where the Taliban fit in the war. Because repeatedly, presidents and decision makers feel clear-eyed about the problem of al-Qaeda. That's a national interest, a vital one, justifies military action, certainly through 2012 or beyond. But the question of whether the Taliban constituted an enemy important enough to send young men and women to war befuddled very smart, well-informed decision makers, and they kept compromising about that question or accepting degrees of contradiction laced into the decision making that ended up perpetuating a pattern of kind of half-war vagueness in what it was we were trying to accomplish, of these measurements like reverse the momentum or, you know, degrade the enemy. And these were that kind of language that as an editor you draw a red line through, say, well, tell me a little bit more exactly what you mean. That ended up entangling several administrations in the problem. The other thing that repeated, and you would have lived this yourself, that was really apparent when you unpack the history, was the contradiction that general after general would go out to lead the war in Afghanistan, and they would say in public, this is not a war that can be won by purely military means. I think it was General Petraeus who said, you can't capture and kill your way out of an industrial strength insurgency during his command while you were ambassador in Islamabad. And yet, year after year, we resourced and prioritized military action over diplomacy and political strategy. We didn't have as ambitious a complement to the military strategy as the rhetoric or the whole idea of fighting to the negotiation table might imply. And even today, in the third administration to take on the war, the notion seems to be, well, if we loosen the rules of engagement, if we drop bigger bombs, if we fight harder, we will drive them to the negotiating table by fighting a better war. It has a little bit of echo of Vietnam, of searching for a better form of the war in order to get to a political settlement without actually prioritizing diplomacy.
Well, in this case, this focuses more on the American approach to this. There are many, among them, say, Mark Mazzetti and other journalists, who have written about the change in policymaking in the United States since 9/11. And I can say, as a State Department person, it seemed fairly apparent that institutionally, the Pentagon, and you could say the intelligence community as well, were ascendant after 9/11, not only in their actions and in their funding, but in the way, the approach they brought to the war. And that the State Department, people like myself and my colleagues, were not.
Yes.
We lost out. Now, when that happens, when you think of the different kind of people who go into this kind of work, it's not a question of, you know, are State Department people smarter than soldiers? I mean, that's not what we're talking about. I sometimes use the analogy of if you're a soldier and let's say an officer and you've been trained to be an engineer, you have kind of a laser-like focus. You can build a bridge, you can take a hill. You don't want a bunch of Foreign Service officers to build a bridge. You want a bunch of, you know, Army guys to build a bridge. But the people in the Foreign Service always felt, well, we have more of a floodlight idea. Mm-hmm. We have a broader, it may not be as precise, but we have a broader understanding. Mm-hmm. Would you say, to elaborate on what you've just said about 17 years of war, that when you have the ascendancy of people who are trained in this way, focused to do something, and you put those guys in charge, that it leads to this difficulty that coming up with the longer term ideas about where you're going, it's almost a kind of an intellectual problem. Again, one example I would give is when I was in Mosul, working in a provincial reconstruction team, I had a number of captains, infantry captains, who were given so-called SERP money in Iraq. And, you know, that isn't what they wanted to be doing. They didn't want to go talk to sheikhs and throw money at them.
Mm-hmm.
They were soldiers.
Yes.
We were not institutionally powerful enough to control that whole story. So, a long-winded question. Do you think that that development, first of all, since 2001, is correct, that the military has become preeminent, and in doing so, it makes it harder for us to deal with precisely the kind of problem that you raised?
Yes, and two other things. I think, look, the military, as you say, is a professional culture. It has its own imperatives. It has its own mission. It has its own requirements. And when the president says, go fight a war, then generals understand that they're meant to go out there and break things and fight a war. And that's what they're trained to do, and that's where their duty lies. And they go out and do that. But it then is incumbent upon a civilian president to balance the military action line with other lines and to bring the full power of the United States in all of its institutions to bear on a long-term goal that's achievable. That's where the responsibility, it seems to me, in the White House lies. And what happened here, and this is where I think particularly during the second term of the Obama administration, end of the first term, I found what I excavated to be particularly frustrating, because it wasn't just that the military was predominant or that the CIA was predominant in its CT line of action, primarily the drone war in Waziristan. It was also that the White House tolerated a degree of stovepiping in these lines of action. You know, there were interagency meetings, there were coordinated talking points and so forth. You would have lived through some of this. But really, overall, CENTCOM had its war, the CIA had its war, and a little tiny compartmented group of diplomats started trying to talk to the Taliban about whether there was some way out of this. And what was frustrating to me, and I don't know what your impression would be, but I look at the diplomatic achievements of the Obama administration, the Iran agreement, the opening to Cuba. Okay, those are pretty significant diplomatic achievements, hard, and in the case of Iran, keeping China on side, Russia on side. And I can only imagine from what I've read that all of the leverage of the United States, including CIA intelligence collection or military analysis of sanctions and scenarios, all of that was brought to bear on the negotiation to get a good result. And then I look at the Afghan example, and I don't see that unity of effort. I feel like the White House almost gave up. They lost faith that there was anything achievable. They wanted to wind it down, but they weren't looking for that kind of effort.
Well, you mentioned in your book the example we can always use of, say, Richard Holbrooke, someone who had a very broad approach and could have applied a number of creative responses and actually marshaled different ideas to try to come to an agreement. And yet, it's quite clear, as you recognize, that in Richard Holbrooke, he not only didn't have the unconditional support of the intelligence and the military, he didn't have the unconditional support of the President of the United States.
No, he irritated the President. Right. And by one way was by talking about Vietnam, where he had served as a young Foreign Service officer. And, you know, look, we all know Richard. He's a big personality. He had been the principal foreign policy advisor to Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign. And while the President and Mrs. Clinton seemed to figure out how to restructure their relationship productively, at the staff level, even just one layer down, there was still a little bit of venom there. And so he never quite recovered from that. He did, I think, have a different style from the President, and right from the first meeting just got off on the wrong foot. But in my research, I went back to conversations I had with Richard Holbrooke during this period, and one of them occurred after he had come out of a session with the White House where he knew he had irritated the President, which for someone in his position, it's a source of great chagrin. This is the person who controls my future and who I'm trying to serve. And the reason was because he had again talked about Vietnam. And he said to me, you know, they really just can't stand it. And then the transcript page says, but they shouldn't be so scared of history. And I think there's a little bit of truth in that. He did have a broad perspective that, however difficult to digest, you know, in terms of personality, was rooted in deeply relevant experience that not very many others in the White House had.
I think that's true. Let's turn for a minute to the people out there in the field we're talking about, the Pakistanis, the Afghans. The title of your book is Directorate S. Directorate S is a part of the ISI, the Pakistani military-run intelligence. When you think of the Pakistani role, and you think of the relations of the Pakistanis to the Afghans, the difficult relationship they've had since the beginning of Pakistan, did you see your book as an explanation of American policy difficulties, or what would you say your main conclusions about what you found in Pakistan, how Pakistan works, how Afghanistan works?
Yeah, my goal, at least, as in Ghost Wars, was to try to capture as empathetically and as fully as possible Pakistani perspectives alongside American ones, independent of how the Americans saw them. How did they see the Americans? How did they see Afghanistan? And equally with Hamid Karzai and the Arg Palace and some of the Afghan decision makers. But as to Pakistan, yeah, my goal, at least, as in Ghost Wars, was to try to capture as empathetically and as fully as possible Pakistani perspectives alongside American ones, independent of how the Americans saw them. How did they see the Americans? How did they see Afghanistan? And equally with Hamid Karzai and the Arg Palace and some of the Afghan decision makers. But as to Pakistan, I think, you know, the biggest character in the book is Ashfaq Kayani, who ran ISI and then was the chief of army staff during some of the time that you were in Islamabad. And he's a fascinating character because he really straddles so many of the worlds that Pakistan has to navigate. He had experience in the United States. He was in Hawaii for a while. He was at Leavenworth for a while. And he understood the American system somewhat. And he was commanding Pakistan's most important institution at a time of great instability in the country. But I do feel like I was able to give a pretty rich portrait of his perspectives. And the thing for us in America and anyone else trying to assess Pakistan's conduct to keep in mind is something that you know well from experience, which is look at how the war unfolded from their perspective. At Tora Bora, as the book describes, because we didn't block the back door, because we didn't have helicopters to lift the Pakistanis into position to block the back door, not only Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri came over the hills into Pakistan, but so did hundreds of other al-Qaeda. They settled down in Waziristan. They ended up hooking up with local groups. They gradually, along with domestic militants that ISI had succored, to be sure, over a long period of time, they ended up setting off the worst period of domestic terrorism and instability in Pakistan's history, starting in 2007, around the time Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. And then by 2009, the place looked like it was about to fall apart. The Pakistani Taliban had declared war on the Pakistani state. They were marching out of Swat. It looked like they might even enter Islamabad. I remember the panic
in
Washington.
90 kilometers from Islamabad
And they were, the truck bombs were hitting the army. They were hitting an ISI building in Lahore. Tens of thousands of Pakistanis died, militant security forces, civilians. And so we were in there with our own problem, which was that partly because of the Pakistanis' long-standing good Taliban, bad Taliban policy, which tended to encourage the Afghan Taliban and anybody aligned with them to go across the border and fight NATO. After all, those are the foreigners who are around here, and leave us alone. We were suffering at the hands of the kind of neglect and long collaboration and then some increasing evidence of active collaboration between ISI and the Afghan Taliban. So we were tempted to tell Ashfaq Kayani, you've got to do more about this. And his position was, you know, his job is to first restore Pakistan's domestic security. And there were only so many hornet's nests that he could poke at that time when things were so unstable. And he would say to the Americans, as the book describes, look, I'm fighting a civil war at home, basically. And I've got to make sure that the war to my soldiers feels like the 98% against the 2% and not the 60% against the 40%. Otherwise, this country could crack up. This is a country with 100 nuclear weapons, too, which are not over there in Afghanistan. So today we can, well, maybe at some point talk about the Trump administration and their withholding of financial aid from Pakistan and so forth. And I think there's a certain logic in kind of changing the rules a little bit and certainly putting some pressure on ISI to come to terms with its own double game. But you have to set that in the context that the Pakistan being pressured today is a lot more stable than the one that was around in 2010.
Yeah. How about the Afghans? You describe that it's important to have at least some empathy or at least understanding of the way that the Pakistani military and society dealt with this, if we're going to understand what happened. How about Afghanistan? How do you judge Karzai and the other kinds of issues?
Well, Karzai is one of the most striking examples. Again, I felt like I understood him. I had interviewed him. I had been a beat reporter on the war over a long period of time. Even back in the 80s, he was around in Peshawar. And of course, he had this reputation after 2009 of having become highly unstable, erratic, angry, moody. And the book certainly describes a lot of erratic words and conduct in private. But the thing that really surprised me when I went back and kind of excavated this again was how consistent he was about Pakistan. And every time an American comes in and sits down with him, he says, why are you not doing more to pressure ISI? Why are you not doing more to bring Pakistan's role in this war under control? When we escalate the troops, I think it's Ambassador Eikenberry says to him, these troops are going to Kandahar and Helmand. He objects to that. He said, you're fighting a counterinsurgency war in my villages. I don't want that. Put them against the Pakistan border and maybe put some more of them in Waziristan if you can, because that's where the war is destabilizing my country. And we would notionally say to him, you're the sovereign president of Afghanistan, and of course we are here with your permission. But in fact, the power balance was way out of whack. We didn't follow his advice. And he resented being a lackey of the United States and gradually rebelled against that any appearance of that role. But the other pattern was, I think we genuinely confused him on our Pakistan policy. He had this conspiracy theory that since we were the world's most powerful country, if we wanted ISI to change its behavior, surely we could figure out how to do that. And the other explanation must be that we wanted to destabilize Afghanistan through ISI's conduct in order to justify having a long-term military presence in the country. And there's a, and this becomes very frustrating for the Americans, you know, and there's a scene where James Dobbins, a diplomat who serves as special envoy, goes out to Kabul and he sits down with Karzai in 2013 and he's stuck on this conspiracy theory and he says, Mr. President, you know, by now, you've got the Snowden material, all the WikiLeaks cables. Can you see any trace of this conspiratorial design? And Karzai kind of half smiles and says, maybe you don't know the plan.
You're not briefed in. Yeah. Very, very interesting. I mean, one of the things that was always striking is that because the American military was, in fact, the biggest contingent of Americans overseas, and the American military was in Afghanistan, that there was always a greater empathy for the Afghan point of view. And very often what I would hear in Pakistan is that the Afghans would tell the Americans would accept, and there is some logic to this, we'd have won this war were it not for the Pakistanis
right.
and for the double dealing and all this. The interesting thing that did was it took focus away from such things as corruption,
right.
Legitimacy of government, or governance in general. When you come up against that problem, what do you think?
Well, it's clearly blaming, externalizing Afghanistan's problems is an evasion. It's an evasion by Karzai specifically, by his cabinet also. And yet, you're right, the asymmetry of where the Americans were and who they listened to at the highest levels was significant. And especially when it wasn't just that the Afghans were blaming the Pakistanis to their counterparts. It was also that this whole generation of American military officers, colonels, one stars, two stars, who went into the field after 2007 and who led the surge through 2012-13, especially those who served in Kandahar or in the East, you know, they lost comrades to guerrilla units that they could see were coming across the border from Pakistan, going back at night, being led in by Frontier Corps border post units. Okay, you can't see beyond those border posts. You don't really know what infrastructure is over there. But after you've gone to 5 or 10 ramp ceremonies, you lose interest in the details
right.
and the nuance of whether this is a reflection of Pakistani state weakness or how much is design, how much is weakness. And so I do think you're right. And then it gets even worse. I mean, you were there during the nadir of it, I think, when even the character of many of the Americans in Pakistan became very different from the days of old. You know, I think there's someone like you who has long and sophisticated experience of the country, comes in and sees all of these people we're sending over as, you know, diplomats who are coming in cargo shorts and running basically a big forward operating base there. And in the context of Raymond Davis, you know, it's not just the Raymond Davis episode, but the arrogance, the sense of that the Pakistanis on the street are an enemy, that everyone needs to be pushed out of the way. And this old hand is quoted as saying something like, what happened to the elegance of old? I think a lot of people who had served in Pakistan before 2001 and who were still kind of specialists in the country had benefited from an era when you could really travel very freely in Pakistan and mm-hmm. securely and get a sense of the country's diversity and richness and complexity. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be gone from some of our institutional understanding.
There was a very interesting article written, I think it was in the New York Times Magazine sometime or late 2011, 2012, something like this, which was kind of, you know, did we take our eye off the ball? That is, were we not paying enough attention to Pakistan in the sense that, in terms of American priorities, do we care about a country of 200 million with nuclear weapons on India's border that could be a force for stability or not? Or do we care about this other country, which,
yes.
because America is committed to Afghanistan's success, and those of us who've been in Afghanistan, we know them and we love them. We want them to succeed. And yet, in a hard-nosed question about interests, isn't it
totally,
more important
totally.
To get
that,
Pakistan
that
right?
That tension recurs in the history. The most vivid moment is when the Obama administration comes in and Joe Biden comes out to both Islamabad and Kabul. And, in the manner of a transition of administrations, the new people always think the other people did everything wrong and they're going to do everything the opposite. And one of the things they wanted to flip was the relationship with Karzai, who they felt had been coddled by the Bush administration, even though, in fact, President Bush, I think, did a good job of keeping that relationship on side. And so the message, though, is this is a new era. You're going to be accountable for corruption. You're going to be accountable for drugs. We're not going to look past all of these internal failures. And it's Biden who's sent to deliver this message. And he sits down, and Karzai says, what are you going to do about Pakistan? What are you going to do about ISIS? This thing he always says. And Biden replies, Mr. President, Pakistan is 50 times more important in the United States than Afghanistan. Now, maybe not the most diplomatic way to phrase it, but you can see the conviction there. And I went to a dinner at his house, so a little bit of memoir I was able to weave in.
This was Karzai's house?
No, Biden's house in 2009, after he came back from this trip. And he had some people over, think tank people over, and he sat down and he thought out loud and said, what if we took all of the troops and money that we're about to send to Afghanistan and redirected all of those resources to stabilizing Pakistan and improving our relationship with Pakistan, maybe get the Saudis involved to try to put more pressure on ISI and Directorate S, and try to win the war that way, through the back door with a country that has 100 plus nuclear weapons. And it was a profound, typical Biden, like, wow. And then, of course, it's completely implausible, so I hope it's not a good idea, because no one's ever going to pursue it. And it just got worse.
Well, you've mentioned that question, and as we kind of wrap up a little bit, you've mentioned the question, okay, we come to the present day, and how about President Trump? He has come out and said in tweets, we've been deceived by the Pakistanis, we're not going to take it anymore, et cetera. And the implication is aid will be, if not eliminated, certainly cut back in a long way, in many ways. What do you make of his position, and what, at the risk of asking to predict the future, where do you see this going?
Well, I think there's more continuity than change in it. You have in the president's national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, and in his secretary of defense, James Mattis, two generals who had long experience of Afghanistan, and in Mattis's case of Pakistan as well. And I think they persuaded the president not to do what would have been his instinct, which is just to pull out altogether. So they persuaded him that he could fight a tougher war, a more kind of Trumpian war, but that it was necessary to continue. And that was really a big decision for the president, to give up on his own instincts to just get out and to ignore Steve Bannon's argument that they should.
Would you argue that part of this was, as people have accused some of the military leadership, that it wasn't so much to achieve a victory but to prevent a loss?
There's some of that. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair comment, and it's one of the patterns of the war that goes even before Trump, where you can, if you go watch the Ken Burns documentary about Vietnam, your heart sinks, because this idea of just fighting to avoid humiliation or a defeat, but having no plausible vision of an endpoint or a victory, is something that recurs in both wars. I don't blame the generals for wanting not to lose a war. That's what you want, generals who are absolutely refuse to lose wars. But still, we are a civilian control constitution, so you have to kind of take responsibility for this at a different level. And the form of continuity that's dispiriting is the idea that we're going to, with 15,000 or 10,000 international combat troops, accomplish through loosening the rules of engagement or signaling determination to stay indefinitely or withdrawing some money from the Pakistanis, that somehow through those fixes we're going to accomplish something on the battlefield that we couldn't accomplish with 150,000 international combat troops. I mean, to me, that's just, it would be really a departure from history if that happened. Maybe we'll all be surprised. But I think much more likely is the continuation of the stalemate that we've really seen on the maps since 2007. Some people call it a deteriorating stalemate. I was at the Afghan embassy last week. The ambassador was very bullish about the gains of the last 6 months. I don't see evidence of that in the newspapers. But in any event, the stalemate is structural because the Taliban have a great deal of difficulty massing or taking cities because they don't have an air force and they don't have an answer for our air force. As long as we're willing to provide that to the Afghans, they're not going to be able to make a strategic leap unless the Afghan government collapses internally from political factionalism, which is certainly a possibility. And equally, the Afghan forces don't seem to decisively be able to clear and hold the rural territory where the Taliban are so embedded. So I'm afraid it's, you know, more of the same and hoping for a different outcome. What I see them doing in response to the pressure that the Trump administration has put on, including the conditional or tentative withdrawal of aid that's already been allocated, is just nesting inside their relationship with China. Of course, that's always been their most important relationship going back to the 1950s and 60s. At times, they balance their relationship with China with their relationship with the United States, and that's, I think, always been the healthiest place from Pakistan's point of view to be. But the advantage they have now is that if you're going to have your most important great power in the world be somebody right now, China looks like a lot stronger, richer, more influential partner than before. And so you can see them backing into that protection and maybe trying to draw, you know, Russia and other players who share antipathy toward the United States into a different kind of pressure game. The other thing I would worry about if I were the Trump administration is that if you put too much pressure on Pakistan with these terrorist attacks in Kabul, they, I think, you know, you could, I don't know exactly what the evidence shows, but you could certainly read that as signaling about their ability to escalate at the expense of Afghans. And so you'd have to play that out before you go too far.
Yeah, my comment on that would be that, you know, the president's decision to really take a hard look at assistance is, I think, legitimate. But as a friend of Pakistan, I think we have to take a hard look at the relationship, because that which you so ably portrayed about the series of misunderstandings that has such a long historical pedigree in Pakistan, this is not something to be taken lightly. And to try to do it differently, because you made that allusion to trying to do the same thing and expect something different to happen, Trump, to his credit, doesn't want that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see whether that element of cutting aid is part of it. One would like to think that the element of cutting aid would not be seen in a punitive way,
but
it would be part of a more creative way of dealing with the entire area.
If it's linked to a political and negotiating strategy.
And takes into account the Chinese role, which was different than my day. I recall when I was ambassador, I would go with the Chinese ambassador to talk to Pakistanis, and we would say, you have the two best friends in the world,
right,
China and America. And our, at least stated aims, were fairly similar.
Yes.
We were against terrorism, and we wanted to see a stable economy in Pakistan. So there is a role that I'd love to see as the second half of the Trump reassessment, which is not only let's rethink the assistance we give, but let's also rethink where we want to go. You know, during my time in Pakistan, one of the key priorities was the security and the safety of the Pakistani nuclear arsenal. What is your take on this? Do you see in the whole tapestry of the relationships of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and America, what role did the nuclear arsenal play in deliberations and in reality?
Well, I think it constrained the United States at times, in the sense that there was a great focus on the security and stability of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and the command that controlled them. And I remember in chronicling the strategy review in 2009, there were two of them, the Obama administration's new team, they really struggled. They spent a lot of time, thoughtful time, trying to identify what are the vital interests in this war. One of them was Al-Qaeda, but the other was the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Now, they said in the Situation Room, we really don't want to go give a press conference about this because we're trying to keep this as dignified and quiet with the Pakistanis. Pakistanis don't like people talking about their nuclear weapons or the risk of them being acquired by bad actors. But the fact that these weapons were there at a time when there was also an insurgency against the Pakistani state was inescapable. And it was a constant source of concern. And the book describes an episode in 2014 where there was a terrorist attack on a Navy ship that was thwarted by commandos, but really quite an elaborate plan to seize control of the ship. And Indian intelligence reported after the attack that there might have been tactical weapons as part of Pakistan's triad on that ship. And if that's true, that's about as close to the nightmare scenario as you ever want to get. The other trend, of course, as you know, in Pakistan's nuclear weapons program is that they're trying to emphasize smaller tactical weapons that might be used on the battlefield for the purpose of deterring India from thinking that it could conduct a land invasion, because the Pakistanis wouldn't dare go into city-busting kind of nuclear war. And just as the Russians are developing tactical weapons and we're talking about doing it, there's a sort of a dangerous trend line of trying to make the nuclear war more conceivable under a deterrence theory. But the practical result of that is you're building smaller, more portable weapons, which is disconcerting.
It's an interesting problem because far above and beyond just the dynamics that we've been talking about in the region, this takes us back to the debate that we had in Germany in the 1980s that the Americans, the Soviets talked about in other countries. And it's almost like since the end of the Cold War, the discussion about nuclear weapons and these kinds of ideas of using tactical nuclear weapons for such a purpose that in fact might make a nuclear war more palatable
right.
for people, that the people who developed the original ideas on this have all passed from the scene.
Yes.
And the new people all have to relearn yes. these issues. And of course, we were used to the dance, the rather well-regulated dance with the Soviets in the 70s and the 80s. Now maybe we're relearning this
yes.
with new players
yes.
and that the Pakistanis are relearning it as well.
Yeah.
So it's a troubling issue and is probably only going to be more difficult as time goes on. And that gets me to my last question here. Do you come out of this as an optimist, pessimist, realist? How do you describe yourself?
Yeah, I think I'm a realist. I worry about the durability of this pattern that's been just continuing to churn. Of course, it's heartbreaking the price that Afghan civilians in particular have been paying over the last couple of years and the rates of casualties and attrition in the Afghan security forces that are now mostly in the lead of the war. And you would wish, for everyone's sake, since I agree with you, that it's not just in American interests or Pakistani interests, but also Chinese interests and Iranian interests and those of the Central Asian neighbors, to prevent Afghanistan from falling back into a 1990s-style civil war. And the question is, how much does Pakistan want stability in Afghanistan, even if it means uncertainty, even if it means an Indian role in the country, versus just playing the playbook that they've played for so long now, which is somewhat on automatic pilot?
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, how much of a priority is this for China? I read as I was coming over to talk with you that we apparently are about to formally launch a trade war with China, and they may have with North Korea and a trade war other priorities with us besides Afghan stability.
That vision that you say, if you indeed are a realist, it's a realist who would say this could be very tough in the days to come.
I do think that, yes.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for spending the time with us to try to not only outline what you've portrayed in the book, but to give us the deeper insights into American policy and the problems that we have, and deeper insights, as you showed in your book, into the real workings of the Pakistanis and the Afghans, which is indeed what makes your book so extraordinary. So once again, before we close the show, I'd like to thank Steve Cole for joining us and sharing his insights on EWI Podcast. Once again, Steve's new book, which is called Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is available, and I highly recommend that you pick it up. Remember to look for us on our website, on SoundCloud and iTunes, under the name of East West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you very much, Steve, and thank you all for listening.